to Resounds, arts and culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Theodore Waddell, Patrick Zents, so wonderful to have you both here. We are coming together under common ground to talk about Bill Stockton, who was a great artist that we're remembering fondly as his work's coming into the attention of the Yellowstone Art Museum. They've got a retrospective of his life and his work, over 120 paintings, sculptures, and we're just really excited to get a chance to talk to you both about your relationship with Bill, and also this really unique combination of ranching and art. What a Montana thing to do.
I would say that Ted and Pat have really led the way in what I think of as Montana modernism. And their work, which is so wildly different from each other, have really led the way for recognition in the country for contemporary art.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Boy, that's very generous. Thank you, Corby.
But, you know, one of the things that you think is atypical is ranching and art, and it's not, because they're both problem-solving situations. So it makes perfect sense, and it always has for both of us. And then another friend, Dennis Voss. I mean, so we were all in the same gene pool, and then we were led by Isabel and Bill. Isabel and Bill knew each other early on, and probably Francis Zenska and Jesse Wilbur. I mean, they were all out of that generation that introduced us all to contemporary art in Montana.
Ted, I love that you said that within the first few weeks of knowing Isabel Johnson, you knew you didn't want to be alive and not make art, and you were 17 years old at the time.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And I've done a lot of things to stay alive, but art was always at the center of it. And, you know, these kids ask you, say, well, how do you become successful? I say, you work for 25 years and then hope the phone ring. For me, it was 27.
So it is interesting. Ted and Dennis and I all have taught prior to moving back to the ranch. Dennis was raised on a ranch in northwest Nebraska. His experience was after his introduction to Montana, he taught at U of M like Ted did. I was actually Ted's student, graduate student. But we all left that arena and started ranching. And I think a lot of it makes sense. Students require a lot of intellectual energy. Cattle do not. It was a transition that really, for me, created more energy to apply to the art I wanted to make. The teaching was exhausting me. So I think, you know, that it really is an organic thing to ranch and make art. And I don't think there's any stipulation you can't do it. What Bill and Isabel did was provide examples that you really didn't have to move to New York, which was the thing to do at that time. All of my peers left.
Yeah, and the other part of that, around the same time period, maybe a little later, is the Poindexter collection. You know, because Poindexter's had art in New York, and they were from Helena, and they wanted to do something for Montana. And so 800 pieces went to the Historical Society, and Donna Forbes, she's the one that talked them out of at least 200. So in that sense, we got to see contemporary art that came out of New York in Billings, Montana. So all of those things were going on. Bill and Isabel and Francis and Jesse and all of that. And my daughter calls them art uncles. You know, and that was happening, and it led us. It really did lead us, and me especially.
They just absolutely wrapped their arms around us. If you were serious and interested in understanding what it was you were trying to do, they just invited you into the fold. Rudy and Leela, Bob and Jenny and Bozeman, who were good friends of Bill's as well, and Isabel's. Mm-hmm. We felt welcome.
Now, you mentioned Donna Forbes, director of the Art Museum, during this time that contemporary art was being collected for the museum and it was expanding across the plains. You know, she studied in New York, and she talks about that schooling as hugely influential to her eye for art, as well as Isabel Johnson, who studied in New York and Europe. And Bill Stockton himself traveled really extensively. I mean, he was in the military. I know that he was running troop trains across the United States, and his son Gilles said that perhaps he got exposed to art in that capacity, but then certainly in Paris, where he was exposed to French art and studied, and where he has met his wife. I'm curious, how important is leaving? Because all of these great influential artists of our Montana times, they all brought back ideas from different places.
It's like seeing a painting your whole life in a book, and then when you finally go someplace and actually seeing it, it's like meeting a person who you've heard of your whole life. There's a difference in being in the presence of an object and being in the presence of an image of an object. It's the same as being in the presence of a person or a photo of the person. So it quickens you. It's like being close to a bass drum. You feel it. And so seeing this stuff is important in person as well as being able to have the solitude of isolation that a space like Montana provides to create in.
There's also the commonality of the land. The land was always the most important. And it has been for all of us. I mean, I studied in New York when I turned 21 in New York, and I could have stayed, but I came back, and I've never regretted that because the land is what matters.
It reminds me of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and the Iliad is going out and seeing and discovering the world, but all of you came home. You were Odysseus returning to the land. And why do you come back home?
Because there's substance here. You know, I think the best way to explain it is through Bill's encounter with Jackson Pollock. Jackson Pollock's work revealed to him and kind of sanctified for him that pattern is a viable way to understand, as Ted said, it's a ground that he lived on. Mm-hmm. It opened his world up, and it gave him a raison d'etre.
Yeah, I mean, it was always there, but Pollock just reintroduced it to him. And the same thing happened to me. I quit teaching to take over a ranch with no experience, and I traded my house for a tractor. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting at the we bought black cattle. Because of the pigmentation, and so they didn't get cancer eye or that sort of thing. So I'm sitting at the kitchen table looking out, and there was snow on the ground. And here's these black cows moving across that landscape, and it reminded me immediately of Robert Motherwell and some of the lyrical things that he had done, and boom.
So that's an important point because it's an epiphany, and it's something we shared with Bill. And I think Jackson Pollock was Bill's epiphany. I saw Ted conjure up this whole vision from the muck and mire of his feed grounds. I have one of those paintings that's hung on my wall for the last 45 mm-hmm. years of those early Angus in the snow right before calving season. And I've had the same experience where you had this pivotal moment. It was while I was a student of Ted's from a visiting artist at the U of M. But it causes this cascade of research that leads you into the environment for, in our cases, that leads to a lifetime full of work.
Patrick, I love that you've said that your entire life is involved with land and sky. And if it's not, you'll go broke. There's a very practical approach to your relationship with land because it is everything. It is livelihood.
It is. It's metaphorical as well. Artistically, at least for me, and I know for Ted, and I know for Bill, those things hold true as well, just in terms of a sense of being and a way to understand.
Pat, I think metaphorical is exactly, I think, how one would describe your work, because your work is really about sound and land movement. It's not about paint or color. Could you sort of describe the evolution to the kind of work that you were doing?
I can, and I'll go back to the epiphany I had, which was triggered by Robert Smithson, whom Ted and his other teachers had invited as a visiting artist to U of M. He said to me, understand clearly the object you're using to understand the land. And it absolutely quickened research into, I studied Buckminster Fuller, all these people, but it eventually evolved to a really intense study of intersection, latitude, longitude, grid intersections, and that finally led to some performance work that involved the invention of instruments to read what the landscape was doing at regularly spaced places across the land.
It's a different way of recording.
Exactly.
Whether it's with sound and maps or drawings or with paint.
There's a lot of research going on now about how we learn spatially through our bodies. A psychologist by the name of Barbara Tavinsky has just written a book called Mind in Motion and how our body's action in space helps us to understand without language at all. And at Bill's work is a prime example that, as well as Ted's, that your body transfers information just in the form of drawing to the thing out there in the world, the cow or that brush that Bill draws, to you. You understand that by actually rendering it physically through all of the parametric joints we have that cause us to move and gesture.
Yeah, it's true.
I love the idea of translating or recording. Most of Bill's work is relatively small. I would say more hand painting or drawings. And I've watched Ted move from drawing and painting to monumental size painting. And so I'm wondering how your body works differently depending on what you're recording or what the size of a canvas is or the kinesthetic of painting, I guess is what I'm wondering about.
Damned if I know. To me, that for every idea, there's a scale that's appropriate. And so at any one time, I have 100 canvases, various sizes that are stretched. And these big pieces came from John Ferry. John Ferry was a painter of the 19th century, and he was painting, doing things that were like 6 feet square when Bierstadt was doing little guys. And so after 100 years of that, I thought, well, I should have a look on a large scale of our environment. And that's where the big pieces came. And I suppose I've done 10 or 12 over time.
You know, I think that notion of scale is absolutely correct. It's each you can move into and get very close, and Bill's pieces are small because they're intimate. He's in very close, like he, I think, said at one point, whether it's the Russian thistle in the bottom of a coulee, which would be very close. And then it's easier to make a pattern with a small brush like he used over and over again at a smaller scale like that. Whereas Ted is backed out and he's involved the horizon line sometimes, and these cattle are almost microscopic in the expanse of the landscape. So you get a sense of how dialed in the scope mm-hmm. that you're looking through is.
The other thing, too, is if you think about grass range as opposed to the bear tooths, that changes your whole perception. And so, to me, the Bill's work was a close horizon where many others, and you know, you can be out at Pat's place and see 100 miles in any direction. Bill was much, much more close to the ground in that sense than we have been, either one of us. And you can see that in the work. I mean, he didn't give a damn about the rest of it.
Yeah, it's really interesting that the inverse of his epiphany came from a guy who made huge, huge canvases that he walked on and left his cigarette butts on and feet print and everything else in those canvases. But Bill took that clear. He just dove in to that expanse.
There is one painting in the museum now. It's enormous, and it's one of the only ones that he did. And it was described to me by Susan Barnett, the curator at the art museum, as his example of, see guys, I can do this just like C.M. Russell, because it was very specific, deliberate. It was away from that sort of what was described as muddy or murky work. And it's a gorgeous piece, but it is very atypical.
Yeah, it was a demonstration. At least that's a story that I've heard, that it was a demonstration to his crony ranchers, grass rangers, that, you know, why can't you really paint, Bill? And so he did, they expected him to.
Yeah. Well, he grew up, from what I understand, not being exposed to much art outside of C.M. Russell in magazines. That was his very first exposure to art of this part of the country.
Well, but he was like the rest of us. We were all pissed off at Russell, you see. the Western folks that have built a tradition, I think pretty much a phony tradition, which is marketable in a huge way based upon Russell. And so for most of our lives, even to Peter Hasrick, See, they thought that art ended when Russell died in 1927. So we're in the interim 50 years between that activity. And so no one had paid much attention at all to this intervening time until Rick Newby did. Rick Newby wrote about the Poindexter Collection and many others, and he made what we were doing and what we are doing more important. But there was no attention given at all.
And I think that there's a critical thing that needs to be understood about Russell. He wasn't a romantic. He was lamenting a loss of a whole landscape and the life forms, including the indigenous Indians that were here as long as the buffalo. And he was lamenting that. He wasn't romanticizing it. The people that came after him primarily are romantics.
And I think there is, with Western art, or there has been, this expectation of cowboy, Indian, horse, and the Rocky Mountain front are the things that we paint. And what I have always loved about Bill Stockton is his ability to see into the most nuanced little detail scrub brush and come out with a fabulous, fabulous painting.
Well, and Pat and I say we're Western artists in that we live in the West and we make art.
That's the truth, and and we've fought our whole lives to defend that.
Yeah,
it's just when I served on the Montana Arts Council, it was everything we could do to get money away from this romantic notion of what the West never was. I mean, the whole thing is a romantic myth, and of biblical proportions. The West was never that.
I like this quote from Stockton that he said to the Gazette in 97, that it was so, everything was realistic, the art that he was seeing. You knew that was a horse and a saddle and a campfire. You saw the whole landscape and there was a story in it. But I had a bug to paint the shapes of things without really painting the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. That's what he did. And that's what he said he did, and that's what he wanted to do. Even his drawings, the napkin drawings from the Empire Bar, they're as honest as they can be.
Oh, yeah. And if you've been to the bar, have you been to the Empire? Did you take a bodyguard with you?
Corby's nodding, just so y'all know.
I've been around a long time. There are a few bars here between that I've not been to. But it is true. Everything was fair game for him in terms of drawing or sketching. Mm-hmm. And those paintings are as real as the little bushes that he paints outside his door.
He and Bob DeWeese, Bob used to keep a stack of 3x5 note cards in his pocket. And he would sit, and if he were doing an interview like this with you and Anna sitting across the way, Corby, he would sit and he would draw infinite numbers of drawings and put them back in his pocket. Once in a while, he'd hand you one if he liked it. But Bill did this, almost never lifting a pen from the paper. They would just observe their environment. And it's kind of a magic thing they both did.
Bob called it scratch and spit. And so we're sitting in a bar in Helena, and Bob, he was doing this, and I said, "Hey, Bob, how much you want for those?" And he said, $2 a piece. And I said, "How much if you sign them?" And he said, $3 a piece. So I said, "Well, give me 4. And so he did. I gave him $12. They said, "Now buy us a drink."
I love that the art museum has these preserved under glass as well. It is a distinct part of history and also speaks to that time spent, you know, at the bar, certainly.
So you know, he has a reputation as a curmudgeon. But if you were his friend, I mean, you could argue with him, but Ted and I have that same relationship. Mm-hmm. There's very little we agree on. But he was a delightful friend. Mm-hmm. And one of the greatest joys is to sit and argue with him because it would yield.
Yield in the artistic process? I'm curious how he influenced both of you.
He had the ability to change your mind.
Absolutely. Pat and I, we haven't had a chance to do that much, but we'd damn and shout and pound the table and whatnot. And then he would present something to me that I couldn't respond. So it would take me 3 or 4 days to do that. And it was too late.
I was gone.
Yeah, he was gone. But Bill would do the same thing. But he did it. They both do it in a gentle kind of way. I mean, it was learning. I mean, it was palpable.
Let's talk a little bit about Fame and Glory. I think it's wonderful that we have a big exhibition of what I think of as a really important Montana artist. But I don't think he was ever a famous, successful artist. And he seemed to almost Disdain galleries and selling work. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Disdain is a very gentle way of saying how he thought about it. He hated it. And I don't know why quite, but Pat and I have talked about this before. I mean, I think he was trying to snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory, and he did that incessantly, I mean, no matter what. I mean, he hated art magazines. He hated critics, you name it. He hated it. And I don't quite know why. See, my direction has been totally the opposite. I feel like my reputation has been built largely by the museums and the gallery system. But he absolutely despised it.
When you're ranching, you raise commodities. In fact, you deal with commodities futures. But art to him was not about that. It was not about making profit. It was about understanding his world. And so I think he would have liked to have had more recognition. He certainly deserved magnitudes more recognition for what he was doing. But it's hard to see at the time. And it's really hard to blame a critic for not seeing it. I think there are people who have. And I think now, you know, this is something that happens to way too many people. But I don't know that Bill would have even, he'd have disdained fame too, I think. He wasn't a product of the world. He was a product of his own environment and his attention to it. He self-created himself. And so how do you market that? You don't. You leave it alone because that's what drives you, I think.
At the end of his life, I know that he was presented the Governor's Award, and they even gave it to him early, and he made a joke about, well, it's not the Legion of Honor. So he had this, it felt like a humor. I mean, his son described that he wasn't a writer, but yet people loved his writing, and he was always a little bit frustrated. I guess maybe frustrated is a gentle word, that his drawings were the secondary part of his books. But, you know, you look at the title of Today I Baled Some Hay for the Sheep That the Coyotes Eat. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just an inherent understanding of the harshness and also maybe a little bit of lightness. It seems like he had a humor about him.
He would laugh at himself readily. There was nothing presumptuous about him. I mean, the book's title is a kind of a laconic sense of humor, but that book's title could take the whole page. It should go, Today I Baled Some Hay That 2 years Ago I Planted after tending the fields and getting them weed-free and then watching it grow for 2 years prior to this first hay cutting that I then baled and will have to stack and shelter from the winter until the sheep need feed when the ground's deep and feed to them, which the coyotes will then eat. The title is a snippet of the amount of expense and labor that he's going to. If you don't know what ranching is, read that book. He talks about sheep in the way Ted paints about those early cows.
Yeah.
You sense the difficulty, not only with the loss of life. The people who raise livestock know those animals. I don't care how big the herd is, you know them. And the loss of them is more than just death.
Far more, because when you're running cattle or sheep or whatever, you go through the loss. You go through all of those steps that you never do when humans die, because you have to deal with the loss, with disposal, with the economics. I mean, it's a whole ball of wax. Almost 100% of the people in this universe have no idea about this, but we do. And I still have this. Pat had some really serious losses, and I didn't know about it. And I mean, I literally cried when I found out. You never knew this, but
I didn't. We had a horrible spring snowstorm that came in, and we did. We had serious losses from it. And Bill writes about that same storm, coincidentally, in that book.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, it's crushing, and yet you have to deal with that, and then get up and go on. Which takes something. But if you think about this, the title of this book, I mean, it's all there. I mean, the whole nine yards is there. And most people deal with the humorous part of it, but it is absolutely not humorous.
And the other thing that he does that is so courageous, he's a great environmentalist, and he, in part of that, defends the right of a coyote to be there. At the same time that he's suffering loss from them, they need to be in the landscape. He's a very interesting guy.
Oh, it is so fascinating. I was digging through the archives and found a photograph of Roger Clausen with two dead lambs that were shipped to the Gazette.
Yeah.
They were in response to an editorial that Clausen had wrote at the time, and Stockton sent him a couple coyote kills.
That's called a reality check. What I do think is interesting about Bill Stockton, if he wasn't selling his work and really not showing it, he certainly had the respect of all the artists around him. And I'm wondering about that. How did that come about?
It was a very small community. And Pat and I, since we're in the next generation, we were blessed to know all of them. I mean, we knew them all. Mm-hmm. And there's only what, a dozen maybe? If that. And so wouldn't think anything of from driving from Billings to Great Falls for somebody's opening or to Bozeman or whatever. But we all knew each other, and there wasn't anybody else. And so we learned from him.
I think the other thing that was always so wonderful about it all, though there were a few, there was always great return on attention to any of the others.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everybody was dead serious. You would not have known that when we were together because of the hilarity and heads tilted back in merriment. But there was always information to be had. And we were inventing a lot together. I don't know what that is. It hangs together today, though. We loved each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun to talk about them so that people alive now know we did. It's important.
And it's also so nice to see those influences in your brushstrokes. And even in younger artists, I see down at Montana Gallery, Tyler Murphy kind of, filling in the gaps that are left. And there's a lot of artistic process to come. But I love seeing Bill's work as young artists continue to come up. And it's nice that he is recognized for all his contributions. And I thank you both for being here and for your generosity in time and in sharing your beautiful work with Montana and elsewhere.
Thanks.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.